Chapter 8
Love.
In my unloving self thou didst create a passion for thee, therefore forsake me not, O Arunachal. Paraphrase of Maharshi's hymn. 30 years later, in far off India, a pilgrim was sitting under the bamboo roof of an ashram in the ancient place called Tirunmalai. It was the same man who in his youth looked one dark night into the northern sky, waiting for falling stars to ask them about his future fate. Many years had passed, many conditions of life had changed, as well as many boundaries of states. Some had fallen down, while others had been newly created in the tremendous upheaval of the two great wars. Yet, in spite of suffering and devastation, the world had not solved any of its chief problems, had not understood any of the causes of these two terrible calamities. The nightmare of a new catastrophe was hanging over the dwellers of this unhappy planet, which, according to Hindu sacred books, is passing through the Kali Yuga, or the dark period of deepest immersion in matter. But nothing of all this was felt in Maharshi's ashram. An utterly different atmosphere reigned here. No brutal, coarse, or violent element of the outer world had any access to it. The former young dreamer was now sitting at the feet of and face to face with a being who had solved all human problems. He was looking back on all the past years of his life, trying to do his final account. He was examining the meaning of his goal, weighing the value of his previous experiences, and new vistas were just opening before him. The shadows of the old attachments and loves were rapidly passing before his eyes and vanishing forever, being unable to withstand the fiery test of the silent presence of the Master. How ridiculous now seemed his former efforts to find a harmony in surroundings where human purposes were so dramatically different from his own, in the midst of clashes of selfish interests and tendencies, and of ruthless attempts to exploit others for his own purpose and pleasure. The tragic comedy of earthly love now appeared in all its unattractive nakedness before the tribunal of his consciousness. From the other side, a new vision was entering the temple of his soul, just vacated by the impostors, a luminous ideal, incorruptible, pure, devoid of any stain or selfishness, resplendent with spiritual beauty, and independent of all ephemeral physical forms. Here was no more possibility of disappointment, of friction, and of misunderstanding. It is only now that the pilgrim understands the meaning of his own wish, whose fulfillment was promised in the springtide of his life by the falling star. He accepted this promise without reservation, knowing that its realization was a turning point of his life. He saw more clearly that the new path led into the infinite, but now there was no more fear. Infinity is life, and all that is finite is in the realm of death. Maharshi has a strange power to awaken love for himself in the hearts of all. This devotion uplifts his pupils, incalculably raising the level of their lives, enabling them to touch the purest form of this power energy that is perhaps the creator of the universe. Love and devotion for the saint have none of the ugly qualities of an ordinary love, like jealousy, possessiveness, exclusiveness, falling under the spell of outer appearances, uncertainty, and delusiveness, and last but not least, the pain of separation from the object of love. Here, the love devotion for the Master does not ask for anything in return. It asks only for the grace of utterly giving oneself to Him, to enter into unity with the perfect and all pervading object. One who realizes the true greatness of the sage understands that he must discard his personality and henceforth make it no more the basis of his existence. He has to transcend the boundaries of the mental emotional self if he wants to achieve union with the object of his love. And these words mean something utterly different from the sense usually attributed to them. He can know the real beauty of the master only by entering the kingdom of the master's self. That which we see of him on the physical plane is a mere shadow of him as he really is. But those who have been in his presence know how powerful is even this reflection. There was one tragic evening in the ashram. The state of Maharshi's health was suddenly worse, and one could notice at first glance a great tiredness in his face and a weakness of the whole body. During the usual recitation of the Vedas, his head was helplessly sinking lower and lower, although now and again he tried, with a visible effort, to resume the habitual meditative posture. Just before 6 p.m., when the temple hall was almost empty, except for a small group of his nearest attendants and pupils, we suddenly saw big stains of blood on the bandage enveloping his arm and even on the white pillow supporting it. The young Indian attendants were terrified. One ran to the doctor residing nearby, who was in the habit of dressing the wound every day in the small dispensary of the ashram. Dead silence fell on all. Some of the women wept. The faces of the men were serious and deeply worried. But Maharshi himself seemed utterly indifferent to all this. He looked upon his arm with a strange expression, as if he were quietly contemplating a thing quite foreign to, or without any connection with himself. Then, with his unique soft gesture, showing the stained pillow, almost as if he would like to beg us to excuse him for the trouble, he smiled. That was all. What was felt by the people round him as the icy breath of death had made no impression on him. All of us who were then sitting at his feet were united in the same spontaneous impulse and understood each other perfectly in this tragic moment without the need of words or even glances. Each one of us would gladly have given all his blood in exchange for that which the master had lost, if it could only delay the imminent catastrophe. The doctor arrived out of breath. He was a short, elderly Indian gentleman, looking somewhat like a Malayali. He began dressing the arm, bidding Maharshi to leave the hall earlier in view of this development, which was to prove a turn for the worse in his condition. But the saint refused with his typical kind gesture. He looked on the people gathered round, and once more a marvelous smile illumined his face. One would say that he wished to compensate for the grief seen in our hearts, which we were quite certain were open to his gaze. I have never seen, and undoubtedly shall never see, on any other face, such an inexpressibly wonderful smile as Maharshi's. A spotless purity, love for all, and a wise understanding of our imperfections and shortcomings. All this and far more was contained in his smile, something which no word can convey. A transcendent beauty reflected in physical form. Only those who have seen it will understand. I pondered, such an ocean of love, such a power of adoration directed towards the sage, could they not have some weight before Providence, somewhat to delay the tragic event? Tragic, of course, only for us. At that very moment, I instinctively lifted up my head. I found the answer deep in the eyes of the saint, and silence was restored in my heart as I breathed, O Lord, just are all thy doings. Today I read a passage which throws more light on the mysterious illness of Maharshi, so incomprehensible to his devotees. In quotes, When the average person suffers for his fellow men, he calls it compassion. A famous contemporary yogi, Sri Yogananda Paramhans, describes it as metaphysically induced illness. For 2 years before his death, Yogananda suffered from this type of illness, and according to his disciples, it was the result of working out in his body some of the physical and spiritual burdens of his friends and disciples. In his autobiography, Yogananda explains this phenomena as follows, in quotes, "The metaphysical method of physical transfer of disease is known to highly advanced yogis. A strong man can assist a weaker one by helping to carry his heavy load. A spiritual superman is able to minimize his disciples' physical or mental burdens by sharing the karma of their past actions. Just as a rich man loses more some money when he pays off a large debt for his prodigal son, who is thus saved from the dire consequences of his own folly, so a master willingly sacrifices a portion of his bodily wealth to lighten the misery of his disciples." End of quote.